little verse before we get into the prose. A foundation straight, strong, bricks mortared tight with well-tested cement. It keeps the house atop steady, practical, secure. A crack, minor, shallow, strays upward, reaching far afield. It shifts the house atop, swaying, tilting, threateningly. A hole, splinters, divides, releasing stale, reused air. It disjoints the house atop, wall, window, violently. Plates clatter, shaking, falling. Pictures pull away from their anchors. It crumbles the house atop, piece by piece. Walls collapse loudly, painfully, and all within is feared lost. It grieves the house atop, fearfully ruining the loss. The memories, fresh, painful, refuse to release what once was. It dismisses the house atop useless, worthless rubble. A foundation invisible, unmade, recreates itself from the wreckage. It rebuilds the house atop vulnerable, spacious, flexible. A promise fulfilled, waiting, unshielded and protected. It frees the house atop to invite, to receive, to love. We are taught to guard our hearts. We learn the ways, for example, of spiritual warfare, as some call it. We are guided to keep out anything that would mislead us, cause us to question, or lead us to sin. We are empowered to create a shield around ourselves, or as we are instructed by the letter to the Ephesians, put on the armor of Christ. The positive thing about putting on armor is that it prevents most things from penetrating. The negative thing about armor is that it prevents most things from penetrating, both hurtful and helpful. When we shield our heart, we do ensure that most harm will not touch our heart. When we shield our heart, we do ensure that most love will not touch. This is the journey in the first half of our lives. We learn what is right and what is wrong. All is clear. We are encouraged and influenced to create a world in which success is mandated and failure is unacceptable. We energetically devote ourselves to a way of life in which devotions and measurable growth is remarkable. We, though we would never recognize ourselves, are like the Pharisee who stands in place and prays to himself, "O God, I thank you that I am not like the rest of humanity, greedy, dishonest, adulterous, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I pay tithes on my whole income." When we create and live in such a safe and protected environment, we eliminate the possibility for community. There is no room for community because there's no space within ourselves. Community can only happen where there is room for mistakes to happen, where doubt is possible, where freedom exists. Community, in short, is messy, chaotic, painful, and wonderful. Community, like faith, engages us in a reality that is beyond us and cannot be understood by our mental powers. It draws us, as a result, into darkness. Many in the church today avoid community. We don't necessarily do it consciously, but we avoid community nonetheless. Community allows all those things that we call sinful, distracting, disrespectful, irreverent, scandalous, and sacrilegious into our lives. Order takes a back seat with community. Space is needed. John of the Cross, in several places in his prose, instructs us to be moral, ethical, and reticent to engage in anything that could possibly endanger our souls. Teresa of Avila echoes this warning. It certainly is, then, a warning that we need to take seriously. It is also an instruction that is limited and flawed. John writes extensively about practicing a discipline to create a night of the senses. His book on the ascent focuses primarily on this discipline. The Dark Night also touches on this topic. His approach is essentially apophatic, that is, self-denial. The apophatic approach to holiness is essentially dualistic. Holiness is separate from profanity. Humanity is separate from divinity. Each cancels out the other. This is truly unfortunate and has some very dire consequences. We can also understand the apophatic approach communally. We, by our interaction with others, can begin to recognize the ways in which we cling to those things that we deem important to us. We can recognize our tendency to immediately rid ourselves of anything that hints at sin or failure. We can recognize our great enjoyment in receiving or achieving something extraordinary. We might even recognize the great capacity that we have to blind ourselves, often by condemning others to any shortcoming. When we enter into a communal apophatic approach, that which worked for us, our discipline and dualistic point of view, often stops working. There is also another approach to spirituality, cataphatic, or recognizing God in creation. When we use the cataphatic approach, we observe and engage more than denying and avoiding. The tendency, however, is to recognize that which is good outside of ourselves only. Both the apophatic and the cataphatic approaches reveal to us what we do naturally. They guide us differently. They each have their strengths and weaknesses. One approach isn't necessarily better than the other, but overemphasizing one to the detriment of the other can skew our image of God and ourselves. All of us, for example, on one level or another, crave attention. Craving might appear to be too strong of a word, and for some it might be. Most of us, however, are not aware that we do crave attention until we are caught up short and we can no longer deny that we do crave attention. Craving attention happens not only between people, it also happens between us and God. As long as we are receiving what we deem sufficient attention, we usually can keep our cravings in check, in hiding. And disciplining our senses, apophatic, or observing our senses, cataphatic, isn't a problem. When, however, the attention that we crave feels about to be lost, feels absent or feels denied, we tend to lose control of our cravings and they become visible. Our actions become inexplicably erratic. We can't explain why we experience difficulty in sleeping. We don't know why we lose our appetite. Then unexpectedly, our levels of anxiety and fear escalate. Our foundations shake. Our foundation shakes, it causes the dishes to fall and shatter, and the paintings to pull away from their anchors. Depending upon our preferred approach, we deal with this disruption differently. The apophatic approach, using self-discipline, attempts to get rid of the cause for the disruption. The cataphatic approach, using observation, attempts to observe the cause of the disruption. The apophatic approach disengages and provides us space. The cataphatic approach engages the disruption and helps us to glean what we can from the disruption. When the two approaches are combined, we are provided space in which we can engage. This is the preparatory work, I believe, of which John of the Cross speaks when we approach the night of the senses. Somehow, this takes us beyond ourselves. Our senses, which we have been disciplining or observing, fail. Our capacity to mentally understand fails. Here we enter darkness. Our self-recrimination, another human tendency, gradually recedes, though probably the guilt that we have lingers somewhere. We can, without the help of others who have entered the darkness, become afraid. We can withdraw. We can mistake the experience as a moral failure, an attempt to recover previous experiences. When this happens between people, we are tempted to cling. When it happens between God and us, we are tempted to create an idol. This, I suggest, is what causes our suffering. When we have the help of another or others who have learned to wait in the darkness and are no longer afraid, we too can learn to wait, possibly uncomfortably, in a darkness that defies understanding. I am not talking about depression. It is during these usually brief moments of time that we begin to espy changes. We, for example, find ourselves less concerned about our efforts and opinions, both of which come from our egoic self, and more accepting that God does for us. We talk less about our relationship with God, which most often includes talk about strength or weakness, and more about God's relationship with us. We are more at ease with our humanity because we somehow know that our humanity doesn't cancel out our divinity. This also can happen to us naturally. And though more subtle, what happens to us is both more difficult for us to see and accept and more effective. When we begin to experience that we can no longer do the things that we used to do, physically, mentally, when we no longer have a flexibility or supple body, when external and internal changes happen to our bodies, when our minds are less agile and attentive, when our hearing and eyesight diminish, we are naturally brought to the night of our senses. We might not call it that, we might call it old age. We can, of course, live in denial for a long time. My parents refused to get hearing aids. And when my mom finally did get hearing aids, she refused to use them. We can, of course, live in denial, as I mentioned, a long time. We can refuse the changes in our bodies. Men that approach the age of 50 and they have to go to the gym 8 days a week. We can choose to use drugs to enhance and restore that which are naturally changing. I don't use Rogaine. All in the end, however, eventually fail. And because we have not prepared ourselves, our level of suffering increases. John of the Cross also speaks of a different kind of darkness that not only includes the senses, but the spirit too. None of us can enter the darkness that surrounds God. We must be invited. In fact, we must be brought there. We can't enter any other way. We can, as John points out, help prepare ourselves by practicing self-discipline and engaged observance to hear the invitation, to recognize where we are being brought. Usually after we find ourselves already in darkness. The darkness of the spirit, however, we cannot prepare ourselves to enter. It happens to us, much like the things that happen to our bodies. They happen to us. And we cannot prepare ourselves. They happen. We experience somehow that our disorderly lives that feel as though they are rubble are being recreated from the wreckage. We can't feel any foundation. Those things that we have built upon, our beliefs, our truths, our securities. And we experience somehow that the recreated wreckage is being built on an unspoken promise that in our hearing serves as a foundation. It is something beyond us, something that we cannot grasp mentally. The way of the cross, which takes us into the night of the Spirit, is that which happens to us beyond our control. We can choose to attempt to regain control, which is a normal reaction, and sometimes and something that we will probably attempt more than once. We can choose to observe our attempts and suffer with ourselves and our attempts. We can choose, probably, several other options. The way of the cross, however, doesn't give us a choice. It happens to us. Love invades the egoic self like a virus and mutates the egoic self into no thing. This cannot happen completely while we breathe. We can experience, however, our egoic self stop breathing for a time. Then the egoic self draws breath again, and we return to experiencing the world through this well-developed and refined filter. Once again, we are surprised by the unexpected ways in which we engage ourselves and others. We readily see our failures, but they no longer, all of the time, take us to a place in which we feel worthy or unworthy. It really doesn't matter. We see that the church has its place, and the order that it applies can be both helpful and harmful. We experience God to be in the church and bigger, beyond the church. we more readily engage in community with all its messiness. We don't as quickly or easily take offense. Holiness and profanity are less likely to be set against each other and more likely to be seen as pathways to each other. I will end here.
Okay.
And you're going to be applauding, I'm sure.